Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to Blog Talk Radio Scan Show, Stop Child Abuse Now, number 2446. NASCA has a single purpose, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts, and showing childhood abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. I am Linda Vitti, an advocate, counselor, and life coach from New Jersey, and I will be your host for this evening. So welcome. We encourage you to call in and be part of our panel. The number is 646-595-2118. Again, that's 646-595-2118. And tonight, our special guest is Dina, a PhD from New Jersey, my state. Her birth father abandoned the family when she was two. My mother's second husband was a child molester, she says, who began molesting my sisters and me at 4 and 5 years old. My mother was an alcoholic and verbally and physically abusive. We were often neglected and left to our own device. Dina reports that her older sister took the brunt of the sexual abuse as he often threatened to kill them and their mother. Dina had lived in silence and desperation until 16 when she left home and lived in a drug house, bounced from home to home. Dina graduated high school and bought a one-way ticket to Hawaii, a woman after my own heart. But she eventually moved back because of her constant mother's guilt via the phone. I think we had the same mother, Dina. So I'm going to introduce you and let you tell the rest of your story. Welcome, Dina.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're so excited to hear your story tonight. And how we're going to go is I'm going to let you start at the beginning and tell your story. About 10 minutes in, I'll stop you, and then we'll go to the panel for questions and for them to interject. How does that sound?
It sounds great.
Okay. And if you get stuck, I'll just guide you along the way. So take it
thank
away.
Thank you. Okay. So I am a twin. I have a twin sister, and I have an older sister. She's 18 months older. So essentially, we were almost like triplets. So as you mentioned, our birth father, he left the family. He abandoned us. We were about two, my twin and I, and my older sister about 3 and a half. My mother, she is an alcoholic, and she shortly after that, she married a pedophile. They met in a bar. And I know that he preyed on her, you know, knowing that she had three young children.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the molestation started shortly after they were married. And they were married a very short time after they met. And it started with my older sister. And once, essentially, she submitted, he did move on to my twin and I. I often was the outgoing one. This is what I heard after everything came out, is that I was a vocal person. But I remember, I have many memories of waking up and being very groggy and in a fog. I even knew at a really young age that something wasn't right. And something wasn't right in my private area. You know, when I was little, I just knew something wasn't normal. I have many memories. We lived in an apartment. We lived in what would be considered, I guess, the low-income apartment. And our bedroom, for the three of us, was in the basement and of the apartment. And we didn't have beds. What we had were a foam chair that you would just fold down into a bed. The three of us stayed down in the basement, and the laundry room was just off the basement. And I can remember waking up numerous times to him doing really despicable things. Despicable things. I know that I developed sleeping issues. Just never wanted to, go to sleep. I became really in tune. I still have sleeping problems actually today. And I know that because children can't verbalize themselves, up till about age 11. I verbalized myself in different ways. I wet my bed for a really long time. I sucked my thumb. I did express anger. And I just internally feared everything. I just couldn't express to anyone what was really happening. And he constantly reminded us. He constantly kept us in fear. And he intimidated us. So I spent a lot of time outside and away, even at a very young age. I was very independent at 4 or 5 years old. we spent a lot of time away from the home. My older sister, she eventually moved out when she was about 14. She had a boyfriend, and she moved out of the apartment, and she lived with their family. And shortly afterwards, we moved to Tennessee. My mother moved my twin and I with him to Tennessee. And I was always very, very conscious of what was going on in the house, and I always tried to keep my distance, even as a very young child, especially as I got older. And I remember when we had to move to Tennessee, I was having to drive with him in the truck with my twin sister. And I was very adamant. And I told my sister, do not drink or eat anything. And he was trying to give us alcohol and things to drink. I know that absolutely took me back to when I was younger. And throughout that time, waking up periodically, very groggy, very much in a fog. Yeah. I have memories of being at a car show and waking up far away from the car show. I could see it, but I was in a field with him. And I didn't know what happened, but I did know what happened, but I couldn't express it. I was in fear, and you accept it. You just go on. So we were in the truck, and it took about 2 days. We lived in Connecticut. I grew up in Connecticut. I didn't grow up in New Jersey. And we didn't eat or drink. I was adamant. I said, no, do not. I said to her, do not. And that was one of the first times that I verbalized to my sisters, because between the three of us, we never expressed what was going on with each other. But I knew what was going on. Yes, yes. Right. I knew what was going on. I have memories of my older sister. I have memories of her pushing us out the door and standing just over, there was this half screen and half solid door, pushing us out the back door and telling us, just go, go. It's the middle of the afternoon. Go play, go play. And I knew, even as a very young child, what she was doing. And I couldn't say anything. I couldn't do anything. I just, again, I was in fear. and I didn't know how to vocalize that. So we were in Tennessee. We finally moved, actually. It was the first time I ever lived in a house with our own bedroom. But my fears were exacerbated because I knew now that my older sister was back in Connecticut, and she was living with her boyfriend, and I was really fearful that even more would be happening to me and my twin sister. And right. I also became fearful because my twin sister was now had her own bedroom across the hall from me. And I can remember mm-hmm. telling her just to keep her door locked and keep her door closed. I don't think there were locks on the door, but I did push furniture up. That was a constant thing, was just making sure that no one can get into my bedroom. We only lived in Tennessee for a few months. For, I don't know, unknown reasons, my mother wanted to go back to Connecticut. So we moved back a short time after that. And we moved back into the old neighborhood and back into those apartments. And once we were back in Connecticut, my sister, she told a friend, she told one of her best friends about the abuse. And during that time, so my sister told her friend, and the friend told a teacher at school. That's how the abuse came out. And so I'll never forget the day that the abuse came out. Crystal clear. I was called into the principal's office, and I had police officers, the guidance counselor, the vice principal in there, everybody in there wanting to question me. Now, this was back in 1984. And this is, you know, back then, sexual abuse was not discussed.
Not that big.
It was something that was actually, for me personally, that I lived through, was stigmatized. And
sure.
If you were abused, you were looked down upon. It was you, the problem, and it was just, it was awful.
Right.
So
right. I'm gonna stop you right there.
Because
I want to go into this really in detail for you, but I want to go to the panel first because we've been going for a little while. So
sure.
Let me first go to my wonderful co-host, Bailey, in South Florida. Hi, Bailey.
Hi, how are you? Thank you, Dina, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Boy, you have some story here. I have a question. Where was your mother in all of this? I do see that she was an alcoholic.
Yes.
But did she not know what was going on?
Well, I questioned that over the years because once she found out, she became extremely abusive, even more abusive. She always neglected us, and she was very abusive, verbally abusive and physically abusive toward us. And she blamed us. She blamed me, and she blamed my twin sister. She blamed us on the sexual abuse, and that's one reason why I left at 16. Mm-hmm. I could not take it. She was never fully present, my mother. I was always the mother in the relationship, always knew that. Even when I was very little, my mother was not a hands-on mother. She was on the weekends, I mean, every weekend. She was drunk out every weekend, all weekend. And we essentially took care of ourselves. For example, when I was 5-6 years old, we would have to get up by ourselves on Sunday morning. Now, this is a positive thing that I draw from my mother and you know, my childhood. This is a very positive thing that she did. She would leave the envelopes out for church and put a quarter in each of the envelopes. But we had to get ourselves up on Sunday morning because she was, you know, she came home, you know, 3-4 in the morning drunk with her husband, the child molester, and we would have to get ourselves up and get ourselves on the bus. And if we didn't, she would get really very, very abusive. So we would get ourselves up, get ourselves dressed, and go to church. And that was my solace. That was my, you know, that's my connection to Christ and where I found an avenue to really go to for my relationship with Christ and to heal. So my mother was very neglectful. It was always about my mother.
That's horrible.
She sounds
really, really horrible. Yep.
Yep.
Personality disorder.
Well, my mother, you know, I for so many years of my life, I'm very self-reflective and I self-aware. And my mother came from an alcoholic home. Both of her parents were alcoholics and her father was very abusive. Certainly doesn't give my mother a pass because her older sister, who we went to live with once the abuse came out for a short time, you know, she went through the same environment. She had to detach from my grandmother and her and everything. And, you know, she moved and had a family and did good things in her life. My mother couldn't cope. This is how what I say to myself. My mother just couldn't cope. And then she married my dad, who it was a forced marriage. I mean, I say forced marriage in that my grandmother, her mother, and my father's mother were very good friends, and they kind of pushed the two together. So, you know, my mother was never ever the parent in the home. And even if I connected with my mother today, which I've since disconnected with her, I would still be the parent to her.
Mm. Wow. So she basically never got the help she needed. But, mm-hmm. you know, what's very interesting that we've learned is that, addictions are a lot of times predisposed or genetic.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you said your father was your her father was
her father and mother. Her father and mother were both alcoholics.
So she had no chance, really.
Mm-hmm. And my mm-hmm. she has there's five siblings. So two of them, well, one of them is a recovering alcoholic. One of them is a recovering gambler. He's the only boy in the family. He was a gambler, and he drank a lot. The younger sibling, her sister, she has extreme emotional problems, very, very extreme. And then the older sister, she was able to cope. She was able to understand. She became educated. So she coped. She went through, she had goals. She had achievements, and she did that, and she met, you know, a good man and got married and had her own children, and she detached from that environment. She, just separated herself. And this is the same thing.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bailey. Okay.
No problem.
We're going to move
you.
On.
Yeah.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to go to Victoria in Minnesota. Hi, Victoria.
Hi there. I do want to thank you guys for posting about the show tonight so that I was able to make sure I got on it. And I just want to thank you for your story. And, boy, pretty in-depth, and you're really explaining it well. When your mother found out about the abuse, did she know how far, like how young you were when this started?
She did, yes. My older sister was the first to disclose once.
Yes.
They brought me in after, and my older sister disclosed everything. I can remember it was a female officer, and I can remember her distinctly saying that in all her years, she's never had a story that she's ever heard like that before.
That's what the police told me when I went, and that was in the 80s. And so
mm-hmm.
when you said 84, I went, yeah! Because, so did you feel that maybe your aunt was a good role model?
You said that. My aunt. Yeah, in the early days, I always looked up to my aunt. I connect with her periodically, but not so much these days. But definitely when I was going through like my early 20s, later 20s, I would reach out to her because I was desperate for a mentor. You know, I just wanted that parental figure in my life.
Because I didn't have no mentors in my life, and so I became, you know, later in my adulthood, and I realized how much, you know, that would have been so wonderful if I would have somebody, you know, that, that at least maybe had gone through something, or at least, like you said, had goals and dreams and followed through with things, you know.
And it was sad because even in school, the counselors, they never, I never once had an appointment with the counselor to like have goals for education. And I always loved school. I, you know, that was my outlet, especially early on. But when I reached my teens, then I was just rebelling. You know, I never was home, and I left at 16. So, you know, my life started
spiraling out. Well, that was probably a very smart thing to do.
Yeah.
But I'm really proud of you for, you know, graduating, and obviously you went to college and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from all that trauma, and I know you said you still have sleep issues. I still do, too. And a lot of it, like you said, a lot of mine was pre-verbal. And I know that has probably been the hardest thing to work through.
Yes, absolutely.
Know. Yeah. But thank you for sharing, and I'm going to continue listening and find out what else happened. You bet. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to go to Darlene in Tennessee, our Southern Belle.
Hello.
Hi.
There's a lot of similarities with mine and your story, girl.
Oh.
One thing, I'm a twin.
Wow.
As well. And the sexual abuse for me started fairly early, you know, but the earliest that I can remember when I did find, you know, like I was hypnotized to find out when was I was 2 years old. But some other things could have happened before that was not as major, you know. But, and I live in Tennessee right now.
Wow.
So, I could tell with the, when you have a story like that, the only way that you survive is through thinking of positive things or dissociating, or, you know, you have a natural way to try to survive. My mother was same way towards my sister Annette. When I can remember at age 11 when my sister was talking to her about something, and like, you're just a whore, you know? So, but I remember, but 2005, before she passed away, 2001 or 2002 is the last time I talked to her. She said she wished she would have killed me when she was a baby like she wanted. So that was the last time I heard from her. I hung up and didn't speak to her again. So she just validated a lot of that stuff. You know what I'm saying? So it validated it for me. And so then I just stayed away from all these negative, dangerous people, kind of divorced them, you know. Then I went on to college work and stuff like that, and graduated with a degree and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm like, I'm leaving y'all behind and I pass them.
You're a survivor.
Yes, you are too. So, you know, we got a lot in common. And please don't dog Tennessee or nothing like that just because that perp was around. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I've been back to Tennessee, and it's beautiful. One of the things that my mom what she would do a lot is that she would extend her fears onto us. So my mother was extremely fearful of everything. She had anxiety, panic attacks ran through the family, and she would constantly tell us, you can't do that. You're not good enough. Nope. You know, like, she just kept us down. She kept us down.
Right.
And then her husband intimidating us and putting that fear, instilling the fear in us and doing what he did, you know.
The value you, yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So thank you, darling. That's good that you knew what was going on, and so that kind of helped with your healing a lot, too. Remembering and knowing these certain things. It's like you did have somebody there on your shoulder, like protecting you in some ways.
Oh, yes, yes. And I was aware of that, too, at a young age. You know, I was so grateful that one thing that we, you know, I did go to church. You know, even though I went with my sisters, I still went. At least she put those envelopes out, and the bus, you know, the bus would come and pick us up, which was great.
Yeah, I did too. We did too.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got that in common too.
Yep. Yeah. Oh.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Darlene. You know, I remember when I worked for an inner city church in Trenton, and we would go and pick kids up from their house because their parents would be hungover or asleep, and we would walk them to the church. And and I always thought that was such a mission field, getting the kids that had nobody else.
Yeah.
So you just confirmed that.
I can attest to that. That is the one thing I always go back to in my life and say, you know, I just try to find the good things that happened. And there were some. But that was number one, you know, where Christ was instilled in me. Even though, of course, I'm a sinner and I failed many times throughout my life.
We all are.
Yeah. But I knew and I know that he's merciful. He loves us and he wants a relationship with us.
Absolutely. 100%. So we're going to go to Leah in New York. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Leah, are you there? Hi.
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, how are you?
Good.
This has really been, wow, it's really some story. And I really feel for you. I mean, wow, just. You sounds like you've really come a long way, and it's pretty incredible.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leah. Okay, we're going to go to Mary Ellen in New York.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. I'm glad to have joined you to listen to what you have to say tonight, and I'm happy to hear all of your progress. I hope you're able to keep moving forward. And I'm going to turn that back to you now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Ellen.
Yes.
Okay, you're in that office, and they exposed it, and you have everybody there. Take it away.
So, yeah, it was very difficult because, you know, when you're instilled with fear for most of your life, you don't just open up.
Right.
So
sure.
It wasn't something that I was just going to sit and share everything of what took place. I was still very, very fearful. The trust, like I didn't know where this would go and what the outcome would be. And I was very aware of that. I was a sophomore in high school and just turning a sophomore in high school. And, you know, I did explain to them that he did sexually abuse me and all that, and I wanted to also tell them about my mother, but I couldn't. I just couldn't. It was about the sexual abuse, and I just wanted to say, and by the way, you know, my mother's been neglectful, my mother's an alcoholic, she's abusive, and all that stuff, but I didn't. I shared the information that I could with them, and I was told by my mother after the office I left that I was not allowed to go back to the apartment to get anything. So I only had the clothes on my back, and I had to go to my aunt's house. So I never went back and got any of my things because my mother only took a few things from the apartment and just like left everything. And that was my mother. My mother was one that would always just throw things away. Never had any mementos from my childhood. I don't have any mementos from my childhood, even though I had certain things that I liked. But I realized that she was, what she was doing was really just constantly throwing away things because she didn't want those memories for herself. She was throwing her own life away. And I realized that, you know, but I didn't realize it at the moment. But that was really hard, not being able to go back and to go to the room in the basement that, you know, you make your own. You have your own space, and just get things that you wanted. We didn't have much as it was. So it wasn't like I had a closet full of clothes because we never had that. I would constantly borrow clothes at a friend's house. And even food. I mean, food was really, really sparse. I would purposely just go to this one friend's house because she had a ton of food. And I always kind of felt some sense of guilt over it where I think she thought I was going to play with her, but I was really just going because the first thing I would do was go in the kitchen and eat. So we stayed with my aunt until my mother, I guess, saved money for another apartment. And eventually, that was just a few months, and we moved into the other apartment. And she just became so abusive, verbally and physically abusive, to the point where I left. I was 16. I left. And I left with the clothes on my back. I went and lived. There was a well-known drug house in the neighborhood, and the drug dealer named Fred, and he let me stay on his couch. And in a way, he protected me because he would never let anybody who used to. It was like a revolving door of people just coming in for cocaine, and that was the drug then, the cocaine, and marijuana, and alcohol, and everything, you know. And it was like a revolving door, but he let me stay on the couch. He said I could stay as long as I wanted to. And I stayed there for a while until a friend of mine at school said I could stay with them if I wanted to. And after that, I went and stayed with her family. But they lived, not that this is anything bad, her mother had many issues. My friends were friends who had many issues because other people in school wouldn't be my friend. They didn't want anything to do with me because I was the apartment girl, and you know, they, even though I was crying out for just some normalcy, a normal friend, normalcy. But they people don't want to befriend you. I mean, when you don't have the clothes that they're wearing. And, I remember wanting to do track. And once I was couch surfing, I'll call it couch surfing because I bounced from friend to friend's house until I graduated high school. I wanted to do track. I was really interested in running and just wanted to fit in. And I started track. And I remember showing up for track, and I had to drop it shortly after, about a week later, because I couldn't make it to the track meets. I had no one to take me. I didn't have a mother to take me. I didn't have anybody to take me. And the girls on the track team, they didn't befriend me enough to, you know, say, hey, we'll take you. The coach didn't, you know, the coach wasn't there. And maybe if I confided in the coach, perhaps, I don't know, I'd like to think so, but it certainly didn't feel it. It wasn't the environment that I felt it. So I couldn't do track. So, you know, I just, by God's grace, I graduated high school. And so now I graduate high school. And during that time, after high school, I was also working. So I did get a job. I was working for the town, and I was doing, like, secretarial work. And then after high school, I got another job. So I was working two jobs. And I ended up getting my own apartment. And it was just a studio apartment, and it was up in the center of town. And I can remember thinking, like, years later, wow, I can't believe this guy actually rented the apartment to me, you know, because I was so young. I think back, like, wow, I was just so young. It was a dentist office in the front and a little studio apartment in the back. And I had a mattress on the floor, literally. I had a refrigerator that didn't work.
And it was just a place just to go sleep, essentially, you know, and I worked and just tried to get my life together. That was just my goal. My goal was always getting my life together. I had goals. I always had a vision. I always knew that something was better. You know, it really what kept pushing me was, this is good now because I'm out of that environment. Even if I'm sleeping in a drug dealer's couch, it was better than where I came from.
Once I
couch surfed and got my own place, it was a step further. It was like, this is good too. Now I want more. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? More achievements, more.
Sure.
I knew I could do it. I knew I had, you know, that in me. So, I ended up getting a pretty good job as a secretary, and I saved up. I got a car, because I actually had to walk everywhere. Like the town I lived in, I was able to walk. And during high school, I walked everywhere. All my friends were getting cars. I didn't get my license until after high school because I had to do that on my own again. It's something I had to do on my own, So, you know, those are big milestones. I mean, just today, my younger son, he got his license, and I was up at 5 a.m. with him to wait in line. and it was a big, huge milestone. And I was just thinking, like, wow, what an, you know, amazing milestone. But in my life, my childhood, I had to do that on my own. So I eventually got a pretty good job, and it was a secretarial job. It was something else. I was doing secretarial work already. And I was about 19, and I met a guy at this office. He was an account manager. He was 4 or 5 years older than me. And I convinced him that I wanted to go to Hawaii. I wanted to go far, far away. And he was all on board. He's like, yeah, let's do that. So for almost a year, we were planning. We were dating, and we were planning this trip that we're going to buy a one-way ticket, and we're going and living in Hawaii. And all my friends were doing community college, regular college, you know, all that. And here I am. I'm planning to just go to Hawaii. And, you know, a big part of me was like, am I running away or not? And I knew that I wasn't running away. I was running to solutions. So I wasn't running away from problems. I was running to solutions. So I never looked at it as running away. So we cleaned at night. We cleaned office buildings and things, and we worked during the day. Now, you have to remember, this was when there was no cell phones. The email was just starting. So I remember that we put our resumes together and we mailed them to headhunters in Hawaii. And we had like a date set and we got our one-way ticket. And literally I had a duffel bag of clothes. He had a duffel bag of clothes. And I had a friend hold on to my car just in case I was coming back. And we gave our notices at work and we flew to Hawaii, landed in Hawaii. And we had a plan that we were going to stay, you know, in the hotel for a week and then get an apartment. And that's exactly what we did. We got a, you know, very 600 square foot apartment. We wired money. We saved money and we wired money ahead of time. And this is just amazing because here we are in Hawaii and now I have to look for a job. I didn't get a job yet. He had some job interviews because he graduated college, so he graduated with a marketing degree. So he had some opportunities out there, and I was just looking for secretarial work because I didn't have college, background or anything. And I saw a job in the paper for a church secretary. Hey, I'm going to apply for this. Apply for it, get a call. I go, and lo and behold, it's the pastor of my church when I was younger in Connecticut, in Hawaii now. Yes, that was my sign that yes, this was the right decision to go to Hawaii. Like I just, I could not believe it was the same pastor from the church, and here he is in Manoa Valley in Hawaii. Yeah.
Wow.
So, of course,
that's
I got
incredible.
The job. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? We're going to take a break right there.
Okay.
And go back to the panel one more time. So let's go to my co-host, Bailey, in South Florida.
Wow. So much. I want to go back to when you were in school and you were being questioned. You did not mention what happened to your stepfather. Was he locked up?
Well, that's the sad part. So he molested us from the time we were very young, so 10, 11 years, however long it was. And it was really horrific. And he got 6 months. And it was in the paper.
Oh my God.
Oh God.
Our names were left out, but his name was in the paper and what it was for, and it's just
Did he have to register as a sex offender after that?
I don't think so. I had no contact after that. I didn't want any contact after that. I only heard one thing about him. Actually, I heard a couple things about him afterwards from friends of the family that I ran into. So he only got 6 months. Now, if you heard the story today, they would lock him up and never let him out. I would hope.
Probably.
I would hope. You know, even then, when I saw in the paper 6 months, it was just such, it was so devastating. It was so devastating. It was such, it really was. And that pushes you back into not wanting to share your story, not wanting, because you feel it's like you did something wrong. Like, you know, I mean, only 6 months. You know, what? It's not worth discussing. It's like, let's just put this under the rug still. You know, that's how it always was. Let's just stick this under the rug.
Well, and you haven't spoken about your twin sister.
Yeah.
Where was she in all of this?
Oh,
school,
gosh. When
like
I say
the school thing and after that.
Okay. So when I say I put the D in dysfunction, I really do. So my twin sister, okay. My twin sister, when we were born, I was born 5 pounds, she was 3 pounds. She was very much a preemie. My mother kept her back in kindergarten, so we never went to school in the same grade, okay? So she was always a year behind. My twin sister, when I left, she left shortly after and went to live with a boyfriend. Okay, so she always followed me along, like whatever I did. She's very tiny, much tinier than I am. Not that I'm not a big person. I'm not even sure how to describe it other than extremely manipulative. This is how my sister coped. My sister became extremely manipulative. She became the victim rather than the survivor. She spent, after she left, because I left first and I went to go live in the drug house, she went to go live with one of her boyfriends for a short time, and then she bounced around from friend's house to friend's house. And then she eventually met a guy, and she got married very young. I mean, 19, she got married to this guy, and she had her daughter, and they got divorced and all that. But throughout that, she was always the victim. Extreme anger. I would say, and I don't want to say this, but extreme jealousy. She has, every time that I opened my life to her to try to help her, she has stolen from me. I will not have a relationship with her now because the last time she was in my house, she went in my closet and stole stuff that I didn't know about until afterwards. And her daughter told me that. And then I realized, oh, that's where all my stuff went. That's where my clothes and my shoes went. My sister stole them. Younger, when we were like 18 or 19, she stole my social security number to get electricity, to put electricity on. Just very manipulative, very angry. And
that's how I can describe her, unfortunately.
So you basically went one direction and she went in another direction.
Yeah. Yeah, she definitely went in the other direction. She still is the victim still today.
Right.
She's a victim. She doesn't have a survivor mindset in that I would tell her, I would say, look, so I found out, this, like I told you, I put the D in dysfunction. I found out years later that our birth father, the father that abandoned us, he molested, so he was a child molester as well, okay? He molested my aunt who did really well and did really well but on my mother's side, one of her children, okay? So I would tell her, because she was always the victim, like, why did this happen? Why did, you know, our father leave us? And then the child abuse and all, the neglect and all that. And I would say, instead of looking at it that way, why don't you look at it in a positive? Thank goodness he wasn't there for us. You know, thank goodness he left. Thank goodness it wasn't our angry, because he was an extremely angry person, father. And I said, yes, we were sexually abused. But look at it in a different light. You know, you have to be a survivor. And she just has refused. Again, she's taken the victim mentality. Everybody owes her. Everybody owes her. I owe her because I was able to go back to school and just move on in many respects in my life.
So did you ever get help? Did you ever get help?
You know, I had to go see a therapist when I gave birth to my first son because I was experiencing severe debilitating panic attacks. Mm-hmm. And I know that it came from, likely from, you know, my childhood. And so I did go to therapy for that. And I've never gone in depth with my therapy, with my childhood. I feel as though, and I don't want to say it's vicarious treatment, but through my education, I definitely learned a lot about what happened to us and how I moved forward and how I have been healing. I think it's a lifelong process of healing.
Yeah.
It's certainly
absolutely
not something you could say, oh, I'm healed from. I think it's just lifelong. I'm self-aware, and I try to be very self-aware and try to say, okay, where is this coming from, and how can I, you know, make it better? So I experienced times of therapy, you know, back then when I was getting the panic attacks, but I was never in therapy in depth, and neither were my sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Neither were my sisters. And my older sister, she's obese. She's bipolar. She's been on bipolar meds and other meds forever, as long as I can remember. And that is one thing that I always go back on, is that I really, really wish we had therapy. I wish they had us have therapy. But again, he got 6 months. It was just, oh, this is what happened, and that was it. You know, there was no support system at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Thank you, Billy. Let me just say one thing. The school really should have stepped in and stepped up and really helped you guys.
Mm-hmm.
That was a safe haven, you know.
Yeah.
But, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go on to the next.
I agree.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, we're going to go to Leah in New York.
Hi. Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. It is incredible. First of all, I love the part I just want to mention. I thought it was very special that it ended up being when you went to Hawaii, that was your pastor from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely a clear sign from God, and that it was all meant to be, and that must have been so special.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as soon as you said that, I got all, like, emotional. It's a very special sign. And it is incredible that, you know, you have two people who can go through the same situation, you and your twin sister, and how one person, you know, we are all born with free will
to make different decisions in our lives. And you chose to be, yeah, a warrior, a survivor, and to achieve and to do more and better. And it's really sad that, you know, she chose the victim. I'm not at all. I can't even imagine what that's like, not to judge her at all, because, I mean, it's a horrible thing she went through. But, mm-hmm. it's, you know, for some people, they're just not strong enough to make the right choices and be stronger. And it's a shame, yeah, that she couldn't get that help. Yeah. How old is she today? How old are you guys?
Well, we're 50. We're 52. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, she functions. I mean, believe it or not, she does nursing. She actually went back to school after I went back. And,
oh, wow.
You know, that's the ironic thing is that, and I've tried to have the conversation with her that, you know, she needs to look at life differently. She needs to be more self-aware. She needs to see things differently. And it's just, there's no conversation about that. You know, you can't have that conversation. You can never have that conversation with my mom or my sisters. They just don't want that. They don't want to face that. They want to continue living their life the way that they're living it.
They don't want to really think about anything because they don't have the strength to face it, those demons. They don't have the strength to really face it like you have. Like,
mm-hmm.
you can delve in and deal with it.
Yep.
Wow.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Leah. We were going to go to Mary Ellen, but I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say,
sorry,
a part of me. No, it was Dina. Yeah. I'm sorry. A part of me also, you know, has, over the years, has felt a little guilt because I have gone on and they're not, but I realize, you know, that's no longer, but now I just wish they would, you know, I just wish they could just, you know, go in, internalize and say, okay, this is, you know, what I need to work on in my life and get the help they need.
Right. Right. Sure. So we are at about 35 minutes left. And you are in Hawaii, and you just saw the pastor that was from Connecticut. So take it away.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and as you know, I've already struggled with my relationship with my mother. So even after I left and I was bouncing around, living on my own, I was always pulled back. She would reach out or I would reach out of guilt. You know, it was guilt. It was like, it was just, you just feel so guilty. It's like it's your mother. And you long to have that relationship, right? So constantly over my life until the last 4 years, I was constantly just going back and forth trying to have that relationship. But she would always become abusive. She would lay the guilt. She would remind me of my fault. And I just couldn't have that relationship. So in Hawaii, you know, I would reach out and call and see how she's doing. And it was just guilt. And I didn't do it often, but I did reach out. And during the conversation, she would just guilt me and tell me that what I'm doing wasn't right. And, you know, instill that fear that she had. She always was so fearful, is fearful. And then eventually she said that my grandmother, her mother, was sick in the hospital. And she wanted me to come back. So there's the guilt because I was the parent. So, and during Hawaii, I actually eloped with the guy. So I eloped and got married. so I forgot
that part.
So we got married, and here I am. So now I told him that I'm going to go back to Connecticut. He did not want to leave. You know, he was happy and, you know, our jobs were good, and I had that guilt. I had that sense of guilt, like I have to be there for her. And I went back by myself at first, and he stayed behind. And I was just going back because my grandmother was sick, and she was in the hospital, and they said she wasn't going to make it. So I was just going to go back and be there for that. And even that was a struggle because I stayed with a friend, obviously. There was no way I was staying with my mother. and visited my grandmother, and the guilt just started. And eventually my grandmother did pass away, but my husband at the time and told him that I'm not coming back. You know, I'm going to stay in Connecticut. So he worked on moving us, you know, back. So we did, you know, move back, and we ended up living with his mother. So it was about an hour away from where I grew up and where my mother was. So that was good because it was just far enough. You know, I was always just far enough away when I was in Connecticut. And and I lived with her until he came back, and he came back about 6 months later. So I lived with his mother for about 6 months, and she was wonderful. She was a very good role model, mm-hmm. very strong woman, very educated. She came from an educated family. Sadly, his name was Greg. His dad, sadly, he tragically died in a car accident, unexpected car accident on a Sunday when he was 12. So she was like a single mother, and she was raising three kids, and she put all kids through college. You know, she was just someone that I looked up to. You know, I loved our conversations. I just felt connected. I felt like, okay, this is someone that, you know, could instill good things in me, you know, things that I didn't know, you know, things that, you don't learn any of that when you're in that environment, nothing that you need to learn how to cook, you know, basic things that people don't understand. I never learned how to cook. That wasn't something that we did. So, you know, those 6 months with her were really great. I learned a lot from her. I enjoyed that time with her. And then eventually Greg came back. And all along, I knew that Greg had a drinking problem, okay? So, you know, we were like college age. I didn't identify it. Maybe I did. I don't know. But I didn't really say, oh, he's an alcoholic. We would just be college kids. We were, you know, out of college and just out of college. And it was like, oh, okay, this is like he's drinking a lot. Not a big deal. So now we move out of his mom's house. We move into our apartment, and we save, and we eventually buy our own house, which is really a great thing, right? Because I remember as a little girl saying to myself, I am going to have a house someday. And now here I am buying a house. So it was a very big milestone for me. And but at the same time, his alcoholism is increasing and becoming really bad. So now I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm reliving the alcoholism from when I was young. Not surprising looking back that I was attracted somehow to that, and here I am. And his alcoholism was getting increasingly bad. He is a functional alcoholic, hard worker, but after work, all weekend, it was like reliving my mother. He drank until he couldn't stand anymore. That was the type of drinker he was. So couple years later, I get pregnant with my son, and my first son, and the alcoholism is super bad. And during my pregnancy, I was starting to get really bad panic, and I was, you know, kind of reverting back to thinking about my childhood and like, am I going to be the mother? You know, these are the things that you think when you go through this, and I'm sure you think this even if you don't go through abuse, but it's exasperated when you do go through abuse. Am I going to be the mother that I could be to this child? Started to develop, so I gave birth, and I started to develop severe panic attacks. And here it is, like, wow, I remember, you know, my mother, fear, panic, all that. And I tried everything not to be my mother, and I'm here having those panic attacks. I would literally, like, drive myself to the hospital. Didn't know what they were at first, but I did know at the same time, you know, and I just needed that reassurance. So I literally would drive myself to the hospital with these panic attacks. And that's when I went and saw the therapist. What disappointed me about one of the therapists was he immediately just wanted to put me on Xanax. Now, I am not a drug person. I didn't do drugs. It wasn't any of my things because of what I went through with the sexual abuse, because of when I would wake up groggy and foggy, and I knew something took place. Okay. I knew something took place, and I won't even take an Advil today. Like I have to be you know, I don't take anything. I just, it's not for me.
Good for you.
So
good for you.
He wanted to put me on Xanax, and I immediately remember being so fearful and just like, that's not the avenue I want to go down. You know, I want to work on my panic, but I don't want to be drugged. So I didn't go back to him because he wasn't for me. And
right.
So I remember
right.
just getting a little bit of help, but I didn't, went to another therapist, talked for a few sessions, but it just, for me, it just wasn't doing what I needed to do. I just don't know if the first therapist with the drugs, psychologist, I should say, because he gave me a prescription for Xanax that I didn't use. I don't know if it was that set me off, or it was, I just probably need to deal with this panic by myself, because I've always been an independent person. I mean, that's who I was. I, from a little girl, it was all just, you know, me doing this independently. And now I have to turn and rely on someone else to help me. That's very, very difficult.
Absolutely. Let me stop you for one second. I forgot a panel member, Victoria in Minnesota, and I feel so bad. She's been holding for 40 minutes. So I just want to see if she has any comments, and then we're going to go right back to the story. Victoria, did you have anything you wanted to add or ask?
Yeah, I just, I'm very, very interested in your story, and I'm just kind of sitting on the edge of my seat here. You know. when did you go back to college?
So, yes, during this time, when I came back to Connecticut and I was living with Greg's mom, I started taking went to community college. I started taking classes then.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yep.
And I just want to make a comment about your sister. I really was in that, I don't know what you call it, the victim mentality, I think you called it. But until I did some really intense therapy and was hospitalized, I don't know how many times, I didn't, you know, people could say all kinds of stuff to me, but it just kind of went over my head. And until I realized that I had other choices, because I didn't really think I did. I just thought, you know, that's the way things are. And I just wanted to throw that in there, but I'm really, you know, glad. And you know, as far as making choices and stuff, like I said, I didn't feel like I had any choices. And I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, and I'm coming up on 34-year-old, clean and sober. And
wow, good.
I tell you what, that, you know, everybody says alcohol and drugs were my problem. Well, alcohol and drugs were my solution. but when I got into heavy therapy, then I had to quit them so that I could face reality. And that was at 24, and I'm 58 now. And my dad was court ordered to therapy. That's all that happened to him. And he molested me from infancy till I was 21 off and on, and admitted to, you know, what he had done and stuff. And I think the biggest thing is people saying, well, he must have had a really bad childhood, and then kind of like forgetting anything that I just told him I'd been through. So, sometimes the people's responses are, you tend to not want to disclose. So I really appreciate you telling your story on here, and just let everybody know that all these shows are archived. And, you know, you could go back and listen to people's stories, and think yours is one that's going to be listened to a lot, because you really have a great story. And thank you for sharing.
Oh, thank you, too. Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Victoria. And I apologize for missing you on the last round. So go ahead. Take it away from, you were seeing a psychiatrist and he gave you Xanax.
Yeah, but didn't want it. I worked through the panic. I worked with my gynecologist. You know, I visited him and was like, is this something to do with, you know, hormones, pregnancy, what, you know, what's happening? And, you know, a big part of me knew that it could be hormones and that it's probably related to my childhood as well. You know, just the combination, because they were debilitating, where I couldn't leave the house. And I remember now I'm working. Okay. I'm also working. I got a good job. I started out as a secretary to account managers, but then I shortly moved up to being an account manager. So, and I was going to school, and I just had my son. Okay, so, you know, the very busy life. And so, is the panic from all that? No, I knew because I was very concerned about, can I raise this child? That was a real big question for me. And I knew I could, but something inside you just keeps questioning that, you know, like, can you do it? My son Patrick, he's born. I'm going through the panic. I'm dealing with the panic, and I'm healing from the panic. I'm getting through it. It took a good year. But before that, he was just an infant, and I can remember waking up in the middle of the night and hearing him crying. Now, our first house we bought was a Victorian, and his room was just attached to the master bedroom. That's what they did back in Victorian days. So his little nursery was just attached there. And I remember waking up and hearing him crying, but he wasn't in the room. And I was running down the stairs, like I can hear him crying. I'm following the crying. As I'm running down the stairs, his dad is completely passed out at the end of the stairs, drunk, because that's how he always was, essentially. Right. You know, this was a weekend, and Patrick is in the kitchen on the floor. So Greg got him out of the crib sometime during the night, and he left him on the floor. And I just can remember picking him up and just being so incredibly angry at Greg. And now, I mean, he's drunk, he's passed out, and I know from my childhood that you can't reason or talk with a drunk. You just can't.
No.
So, you know, here I am literally kicking him and kicking him and screaming. It's like, he's drunk, like, you know, but I was just so angry that he would leave our child in the kitchen like that. And that's when I made it, that moment I made up my mind that I have to leave and divorce him. And so I did. We did get divorced. And the good thing is that, you know, Greg is a functioning alcoholic, but he's not an angry alcoholic. He wanted help. He always wanted help. He has gotten help over the years. So what I struggled with was, here I am. I'm essentially repeating almost like things in my childhood that I didn't want to, like being divorced, right, coming from a divorced home. Alcoholic, you know, being a single mom. These are the things that I just didn't want. And you're labeled that's what's going to happen to you. And now they're coming to me. So I just didn't want it. So I really struggled with a couple things at this point in my life. So Patrick was born when I was 27. So that was shortly thereafter, between 28, 29. Just before 29 was when we were working out the divorce. And he was okay with the divorce. He didn't want it, but he understood. But he wanted to be he wanted to be in Patrick's life, because remember, his father passed away when he was 12. So I really struggled with not having my birth father, having the father figure that I did have. And then didn't even mention my mother's third husband, but I can get to that if you'd like, and that father figure. So I wanted Patrick to have a father figure, and in my mind, I justified that even though he's an alcoholic, it's an alcoholic, it's not an abuser, right? But it is an abuser, thinking back. So I agreed that he, and so the going through the divorce, they were going to grant me full custody, and have Greg visit. I mean, it's full custody, but with Greg like visiting on getting him on Wednesdays and getting him on the weekends. And
right.
You know, to me, that's just not being a full father figure. I wanted him in his life. This is probably one of my biggest guilty decisions, the worst decision that I could probably make in my life. And I decided, I knew a girl whose boss was divorced, and they had shared custody where the kids would go back and forth. And I decided that we would do that. We would go, Greg would get him a week and I would. Now, here I am putting my child, my two-year-old, in with an alcoholic. And
right,
I questioned that. And I questioned, why did I do that? Greg got married 6 months after I left. Okay, after I left and got divorced. So he got married really quick. He's still married to the woman. And she was a church-going Christian woman. She doesn't drink. So that's a really, like, that's a really tough time in my life because I still have problems with my decision on why I made that decision. And a part of me knows it was a very selfish decision that I allowed my child, that here I am, I want to protect, to live with his father. And I struggle with that because I wanted him to have his father in his life. I didn't want to take his father away. His father wasn't, you know, physically abusive, but he was an alcoholic. So I struggled with that. And I've had many conversations with my son, and we did bring him to therapy when he was 10 or 11 because I wanted to make sure that he was on the right path, Patrick was, and that he was doing okay. And the therapist actually said after a few sessions, he said, I have to tell you both, he said, Patrick is doing great, maybe you two need to be in therapy, which I struggle. And he, you know, he meant it in a funny way, but So at that point I struggled with that with Patrick, but he did. He went back and forth to his dad's and then to our house because eventually a year later I met my husband who I'm married to now, and I dated him for a little bit. I was in Connecticut and my husband was in New Jersey, which is how we ended up in New Jersey. So I would go back and forth, and he would come back and forth to Connecticut, and we eventually got married. My husband was a huge, positive force in helping me through having Patrick go to his dad's back and forth and just being an advocate of he's doing good, you know, you're a good mother, you know, all that stuff. I mean, he was just a huge positive force in my life, encouraging me to go to school. You know, I went and I did graduate with my undergrad, and then I told him I wanted to continue and get my master's degree because I wanted to teach at the university level and mentor students and help, you know, students in Trenton. Mm-hmm. I did teach in Trenton for a while. And he encouraged that, and I went on and got my PhD in my late 30s. I never stopped going to school from when I started.
What'd you get your PhD in?
I got my PhD in education, and I specialize in human behavior. My dissertation was on resiliency and bullying. I focused on bullying. A big part of me wanted to focus on sexual abuse, and at that time, I don't think I was ready to really dig into a lot of things. But I wanted to also focus on resiliency because resiliency to me was key and was really essential in a lot of things in my life and being resilient. So I did bullying and resiliency and through forgiveness. Forgiveness was the framework of my dissertation. I used
That's
the
wonderful.
Forgiveness model. Yeah.
I love that.
So
I just want to tell you, we have to go to the panel in a little bit. But we have only less than 15 minutes left. So I want you to get to whatever you want to get to, and then we'll go to the panel.
Yeah, that's it, except for I did have my second son. And, you know, he was born in my late 30s, and he's 17. He got his license today, and, you know, he's doing great. And my older son is doing wonderful, too. He's you know, 24. He's out of the house. He graduated, you know, at university, and he works very hard, and I've asked my older son, you know, a few times, I said, no, was it okay going back and forth with your dad and mom? Because you know, I want to know. He's like, mom, you've always asked me that, you know, my childhood was good. I got two families, you know, I have brothers. I'm good. I'm good, Mom. So that's
wow, reassuring. That's awesome.
Yeah, that really reassures me, you know. Yeah. And here we are today.
You're a crisis counselor, too. I am. Got a second minute?
Yes, I am. I'm a crisis counselor on the National Crisis Hotline, and I'm in school for a second master's degree in counseling and specializing in forensic counseling and crisis and trauma. And I'm also certified in many different crisis and trauma and suicide awareness and a lot of other certifications. So I
awesome.
Work with people, yeah, that are going through, you know, a crisis and a trauma. And I know that that has always been my calling. I know that God has prepared me and
mm-hmm.
you know, put me through these experiences. And when he knew I was ready to face everything and to get to where I am today, I know that's the place, you know, that he's put me. And that's why I'm back in school and I'll be graduating shortly.
Absolutely. That is absolutely wonderful.
So why don't we stop there, and we'll go to the panel to say their final thoughts and goodnight, and then I'm going to give you the floor until it's over. Okay, we'll go first to Bailey in Florida.
Wow. First, I have to congratulate you on getting all these degrees, because you never, it doesn't sound like you ever really had intense therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So you really helped yourself, or you learned your own coping skills to get through all these things and continue on and live a decent life. I mean, a very good life. So I have to, you know, congratulate you on that. Going back to the fact that you married an alcoholic and you came from a home of alcoholism, it's very interesting how, you know, it's something that we never, I can relate to it in a different level because I was married to an abusive, I'm a survivor of domestic violence, and after 21 years, my marriage ended. And a few years later, I ended up in an emotionally abusive relationship. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I didn't see those signs immediately. But we tend to, no matter, and I had a lot of therapy and I still have therapy. We tend to go back to what we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
We're so, like, I was so used to the drama.
Yeah.
You know, so it's something that's what I'm continuing to work on. You are very, very lucky that you found your second husband and you
mm-hmm.
moved past all of that and you're able to keep a functioning family and life. But, you know, it's not abnormal. And I guess it's validating that in each of us in different situations do that same vicious cycle until
mm-hmm.
we finally break it. So I'm glad that things worked out with your son and that, mm-hmm. you know, your kids, both of your kids are in good places.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Bailey. Okay, we're going to go to Leah in New York.
Yeah, wow. This is so empowering and uplifting. I really think that you are incredible. That's a lot of achievements and resilience, I think, was key when I heard that. I think that is really key, that and faith,
mm-hmm.
being resilient. Because you need to be able to have that to get through anything like that in life, so many things. You never know what life will throw at you.
No. Nope.
Wow. It's unbelievable. That's
for sure.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with everything. Yeah.
Thanks, Leah.
Okay, we're going to go to Victoria in Minnesota.
Yeah, again, thank you for your story. And I do want to say I'm really glad that you're doing the suicide prevention stuff, because I've called suicide prevention lines a lot. And obviously, I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
And in the background, I know that a lot of my friends who have, you know, been through trauma and stuff have called suicide prevention lines and haven't gotten a whole lot of support. But with some people's background, they seem to be more effective than others. And just all the things that you're into is just so wonderful. With helping other people, you know, not everybody can do that. It's a good thing if you can. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to, you know, thinking of your story, I just wanted to point out that you must have some really great intuition when you were riding with your abuser to not drink anything. I mean, that stands out to me where, you know, because I can remember things and, you know, and then also fearing about having a child that you might repeat, you know, behaviors and stuff. I had the same thing with my son. And it was really, really difficult because I was afraid all the time. It's a severe panic that I'm going to do something wrong, you know. And I talked to him, too, now later. And he just turned 35. And at one point way back, I was really very ill and I almost died. And I asked him, I said, would it have been better if I would have given you up, you know, for adoption, you know, and you would have had a different life? He goes, Mom, I have no regrets. And I mean, I just started crying. And every time I think of that, I'm just like, wow, you know, that he could say that is just so, you know, like you said, so reassuring. And both my kids are doing wonderful. But it just, you know, it just amazes me that, that we can do something positive in our life despite all this crap. So thank you again for sharing your story. And I hope we connect at some time in the future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Victoria.
Okay.
So, Dina, tell us what you're doing now and what your life is like now and how you cope on a daily basis.
Yeah. So, you know, with going through my second master's degree in counseling, I have become like an advocate of expressive arts therapy. I really believe in expressive arts therapy and utilizing like the narrative therapy, you know, especially in the healing process, especially with crisis and trauma, because I think when we can express ourselves, it's extremely powerful. And I also really am an advocate of reflective writing and how that can help in with anxiety and past pain. So I'm really interested in that. And when I do start practicing outside of the crisis hotline, you know, that those are the things that I'm looking into now and getting even more education on the expressive arts therapy and how to use that with clients. So aside from, you know, being in school, just finishing up in my degree, you know, I'm on the crisis hotline, but I also teach. I'm a college professor. I've been teaching for, gosh, more than 15 years. I started teaching in Trenton at a community college. I wanted to be in that environment to help, you know, other young adults.
Right.
And so I'm still teaching. I teach online, and my family, of course, is everything. And we spend a lot of time traveling, or we did. We used to spend a lot of time traveling around the world. I always wanted to do that, and I'm really blessed that, you know, God has given me the opportunity in the life to do that with my husband, who is very successful in his own right. My family, you know, the four of us, we like to, our time together was always spent traveling and visiting different places around the world. And we're also big sailors. My younger son is an active sailor who sails competitively. So we spend a lot of time on the water together as well as a family. But as far as my professional life, that's what I'm doing. I'm just focusing on, you know, getting that degree and getting into practice and helping those in a crisis and trauma and forensic counseling. Forensic counseling, I'm not sure if you're familiar with, but it is, you know, being an advocate for those who are abused and determining if a child was sexually abused,
yes.
Helping police departments mm-hmm. through that. So that's a real big passion for me, you know, if I can just take my, and you know, is it Leah or Victoria, when she said something about intuition, that's exactly what has gone through my mind many times over, even when I was little. Like, I was very, very intuitive and very in tune, and I know that about me. I know that I'm very intuitive, and I do think that was part of, just, you know, a small part of how I was able to move through everything and continue. You know, like I said from the beginning, it's a lifelong process. I mean, it's lifelong. You know, I still am working on my self-regulation with some of my emotions. You know, I tend to get kind of emotional about certain things, and I have to work
yep.
through that. But I'm aware, and my husband, you know, more so is having that partner that is open to working, you know, with me and our relationship. I'm really blessed to have him and to have that.
Let me answer this. As I'm a trauma counselor as well. And
okay.
I'm just wondering, when you were talking about getting triggered and getting too emotional, what would you say to the listeners? How do you deal with that when you're in a professional setting and you're getting triggered just like everybody else on the healing journey?
Triggered in an emotional way of hearing other
yep.
people's trauma? Yeah, you know, that happens to me on the crisis hotline, and I feel like, ooh, I'm getting a little prepared. Now, it's not face-to-face right now, but this is like my little preparedness to help me get through this. Yeah, you know, that's a really tough thing. It's hard to separate, you know, those emotions and hearing other people's stories, even tonight through the panel and other people sharing what they've gone through. But I remind myself that what they're sharing, at the same time they're healing. And so I don't want my emotions to get in the way of that. You know, so I have to remind myself of that, and I have to allow them to let them tell their story. This is their story, and that's why I like expressive arts therapy so much, because you can tell your story, and when you're ready to talk about what you just drew or, you know, what that means to you, you can then have that conversation with you know, in the therapeutic relationship with someone that you trust, like us, you know, like a counselor. And
sure.
It's a good way to allow them to express themselves and then start to talk about it and allow us to look at, you know, the drawing or whatever expressive art you use, and use that kind of like as a, even like a foundation, so that I don't get too emotional, you know, but that
right,
is something
right.
that's hard. And it's something that I do, you know, I think once I get into counseling face to face, that's something that I need to be very self-aware of and how to not get too emotional.
We have one minute left, and I just thought of a great question for the listeners with the 90 seconds. What would you say to someone who is trying to figure out if the child was sexually abused?
Oh, any sign. There's so many signs, like the bedwetting, just a different behavior that they normally didn't display. If there's any sign of anger, they don't want to hug you, they think that children normally do. If you see a child be, you know, they're depressed or they're disheveled or they're inward or they're taking some emotions out on you and becoming angry, there's something else going on. Be really self-aware of what is going on with your children, in that, you know, you don't want to be over aware. You don't want to be too much, but you want to be just aware of their emotions and what is, connect that with their behavior. So their cognition, their emotions with the behavior.
That's all we have time for. You did such an excellent job. We thank you so much. And if anybody wants to find you, this taping will be archived on NASCA. org. Thank you, everybody. I am Linda V from New Jersey, and good night.
Thank you.
Another tomorrow. that's gone with you.